The question of a company's residence is important in that it will determine the extent to which it is within the charge to UK corporation tax. A company which is UK resident will pay corporation tax on its worldwide income. A company which is non-UK resident will pay corporation tax on profits of a permanent establishment and on any income or property rights held by all forms of permanent establishment. In addition, tax will be payable on certain chargeable gains. We shall look at these later. It follows that it is important to determine the residence of a company. In looking at this question, we have three elements to consider: case law, statute, and double tax treaties. Turning first to case law, the most important case that we have is the De Beers Consolidated Mines and Howe. In this case, it was stated that the company resides where its real business is carried on, and the real business of a company is carried on where the central management and control actually abides. The company had been established in South Africa, and its main business was carried on there. However, the controlling board of directors exercised its powers in the UK. The company was held to be resident in the UK. Similarly, in a later case, Bullock and Unit Construction Limited, a company which was formed in South Africa, had a constitution which gave control to the board of directors, who had to hold their meetings outside the UK. However, as a question of fact, it was found that real control was being exercised by the directors of the parent company in the UK, even though this was unconstitutional. The decisions in both of these cases demonstrated that the question of central management and control is one of fact. In addition, we have Statement of Practice 1 of 1990, which sets out the revenue's view quite clearly. They will look to the highest level of control. The place of central management and control is to be distinguished from the place where the main operations are carried on, although often they will be in the same place. There is no minimum level of activity required. Control can be exercised passively as well as actively. Factors which influence a decision in one case may carry no weight in another case. Where the board of directors meet will be important. However, it is not necessarily conclusive. It will be significant only insofar as the meetings are the medium through which the control is operated. As a result, it is possible for control to rest in the hands of one person, such as a chairman or a major shareholder. In SP1 1990, the revenue outlined the following approach. Do the directors actually exercise central management and control? If they do, then they will seek to establish where it is exercised. If they do not, then they will seek to establish who does exercise central management and control and where. The revenue recognizes that the situation regarding subsidiary companies is not straightforward. A parent company will have some degree of influence over the actions of a subsidiary. It is necessary to distinguish between the parent exercising normal powers of a majority shareholder in general meetings and the parent overriding the powers of the directors, as in the case of unit construction. The revenue will look at the amount of autonomy the subsidiaries have as regards to decisions on marketing, investment, production and procurement. In the recent case of Woods versus Holden, it was held that although the directors of the company had been guided by the UK owners and tax advisers, it was still the directors who took the final decision. Turning now to statute. Statutory provisions relating to residence were introduced by Section 66 of the Finance Act 1988 and are now in Section 14 of the Corporation Taxes Act 2009. This states that a company incorporated in the UK will be regarded for the purposes of the Taxes Act as resident in the UK. This incorporation rule became effective on the 15th of March 1988. The rule does not apply to a company which immediately before this date was carrying on a business, was non-UK resident as a result of a Treasury consent, and that consent was a general consent such that the company was taxable in a territory outside the UK. However, such a company will come within these rules if, after the 15th of March 1988, they cease to carry on a business, or in the case of a general consent, cease to be taxable in a territory outside the UK, or central management and control of the business is moved to the UK. Finally, we need to consider double tax treaties. As we will see in a later lecture, the UK has entered into over 100 double tax treaties with various countries. The standard double tax treaty will include a tiebreaker clause in the section that deals with residents. In the case of a company, the tiebreaker will be based on where the effective management of a company is. You'll note that in the case of a double tax treaty, the tiebreaker is based on effective management, whereas when we were looking at the case law, the De Beers case told us we needed to look at central management and control. Many commentators argue that the double tax treaty test is one that takes place at a lower level. The revenue in SP1 1990 recognizes that the place of effective management could be different to the place of central management and control. However, it is important to note that a company can only have one place of central management and control at any one time. When we consider the position under double tax treaties, it's important to be aware of the provisions of Section 18 of the Corporation Taxes Act 2009. This section provides that where a company is held to be non-UK resident for the purposes of a double tax treaty, it shall be held to be non-UK resident for all purposes of UK tax. Let's consider dual resident companies. It is still possible for a company to be dual resident if the residence rules of the UK and of another country are both satisfied. In the past, dual resident companies have been used to gain a tax advantage in the UK, particularly in relation to group relief. As a result, legislation now contains anti-avoidance rules relating to dual resident companies. The rules only apply to dual resident investment companies. For these purposes, a dual resident company is one that is resident in the UK and is also within the charge to tax under the laws of a territory outside the UK, either because it derives its status as a company from those laws, or because it has a place of management in that territory, or because under those laws it is regarded, for any other reason, as resident in that territory. You will recall that these rules only apply to a dual resident company that is an investment company. For these purposes, a dual resident investment company is a dual resident company that is not a trading company throughout the accounting period, or one that is a trading company but whose trade consists of acquiring and then holding shares, securities, or other investments in other companies or financial activities. These could include a group banker or financial services company. If our company is a dual resident investment company, then what are the restrictions? First, group relief. No relief is available if the surrendering company is a dual resident investment company. Section 343, which gives relief for the carry forward of losses on the transfer of a trade, does not apply to a dual resident investment company. As far as capital gains are concerned, the no gain, no loss rule on transfers does not apply if the disposal is to a dual resident investment company. The rules relating to a group being treated as one trade do not apply if the company acquiring the new asset is a dual resident investment company. Finally, on capital allowances, an election cannot be made for a transfer between companies to be made at tax written down value.